Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
Oh, my goodness. You get all caught up in things and you just totally lose track of time. Hi, everybody. I'm Andrew Langer. I'm in for Tony Katz today on Tony Katz Today. So glad you could join me. Listen, we got a great hour. We're going to be joined in a couple of minutes by Scott Shepard from the Free Enterprise Project. They'll talk about the shareholder loss that they're doing. We'll be talking with Robert Bork Jr. later on about shenanigans at the FTC. By the way, Carl, I'm pulling up some other audio to put into the folder here for this first segment. So just so you know, so we can move on that. But I do want to finish up this conversation about what Joyanne Reed was saying and the lies that we've been talking about here. I think we broke it down. That clip was only less than 2 minutes long, and it was filled with just lie after lie. Here is this is the tail end of Joyanne Reed's lesson about the collapse of civics, the failure of civics in America. Again, I would say being driven in no small measure by these people on MSNBC. But then at the very tail end of the clip, Joyanne Reed says this. Let's play cut number 12.
Between the way that the government actually functions, which is what Democrats are good at, and the way you feel, which is what Republicans.
So do you really think? I mean, is that accurate that Democrats are better at the functioning of government? I think, first of all, right, when we talk about this, the Democrats are just as manipulative in terms of emotion as anybody, any other political group can be. I think the main difference is, this is just, again, so fascinating about this. Let's start with the issue of feelings. Democrats are the ones who claim to be the party of science. Progressives claim to be the philosophy of science, yet they reject science at every turn, whether or not it comes to biology and gender, or whether or not it comes to issues of life, or whether or not it comes to the physics and physiochemistry of electric vehicles, whether or not it comes to issues of climate, whether or not it comes to epidemiological science and COVID-19. Masks and all of that. That's why they want control over the means of media, after all, is that they don't want to focus on rationality. They want to focus on feelings. And the other part of it, of course, is I want somebody to name me a democratic government that runs well. It's times like these, I wish we were taking phone calls on Tony's show, because that would be an instant, an instant call out. Name me a government, democratic government, that's functioning well. New York, Chicago, California, Baltimore, my old stomping grounds where I used to do radio. All of these cities firmly in Democratic control, all of them falling apart, well, in California being a state. And then you pull that out writ large to what the Biden administration is doing. And again, because I should have teed this up with this segment as we come back for the hour, the State of the Union's tonight. And Joe Biden is going to lie to all of us and tell us that the State of the Union is strong. And one of the narrative talking points they're going to use is something that Corinne Jean-Pierre and others have been saying. This is a president that has done more in the first 3 years of his administration than most presidents do in two terms. Now, that's not saying that it's either good or bad. Well, he's doing stuff. Yeah. I would submit that there is merit to the possibility that Joe Biden has done more in his first 3 years to transform America into something else than any other president has done in two terms. I think that's probably right, but that's not a good thing from my perspective. And I would say from the perspective of most people. And what I mean by that is there's one objective measurement here. The left would say it's not. Which is the cost of regulation in America. Donald Trump kept regulatory costs constant for his 4 years in office. About $2.25 trillion. That's still a honking huge amount. Obama had doubled it in his two terms from $1.1 trillion to $2.25 trillion. Donald Trump kept it steady which meant we didn't grow it by, you know, almost $1 trillion, which is huge. Huge. It's huge. Joe Biden, in those first 3 years, has grown the regulatory state by $750 billion. It'll probably be a full trillion by the time he leaves, maybe more. And if we stay on this trajectory, it'll be about $7 trillion a year by 2030. So by that token, by having grown the regulatory state's cost by $750 billion, yeah, he's done more than any other president in his first two, in his first 3 years, than any president might have done in their 2 terms in office. Maybe I might quibble on that again with what Barack Obama did. Actually, maybe he will, if you think about it. Right? 8 years in office, Barack Obama grew the regulatory state by, what did I say, $1.1 trillion. Joe Biden's on track to do that in his first term. And what that means is that it gets down into every aspect of people's everyday lives. That's not a good thing. Now, we could talk about the opportunity cost. We could talk about this and that and the other thing. So you know, this is going to be the talking point this evening. And so, yeah, I dispute this. Oh, my God. This idea that Democrats are better at running the government. The only thing that Democrats are good at, besides growing the size of government and increasing the scope of bureaucracy, is finding ways to stick their hands in your pocket to give your money to somebody else. Now, for them, again, that's a feature, not a flaw. That's what they want. They want to stick their hands in your pocket and take your money and give it to somebody else. Or take your money and use it to buy goods or to seize goods to give to somebody else. They're good at that. But you know something? That doesn't take any talent. It doesn't take any talent to be a thief. Really. And I'm apologies to all the thieves out there who would dispute that. I hope I haven't offended the thief class that listens to Tony's show. It's like this. You know, I'm reminded of this example. Because, again, this is part of the lie. You know, one of the things that they said, they said that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, was successful because X number of people, I think it was, let's say, 10 million more people got insurance than had insurance before. And that's the success. It means the Affordable Care Act worked. Well, yes and no. On the one hand, if your goal is to measure the number of people who got insurance, well, sure. Right, but when you threaten people with penalties if they, you know, with the force of law, and you mandate that they buy a good, you threaten them with penalties if they don't buy the good, and you promise to subsidize those who can't afford a good, well, then it's not rocket science when more people buy that good. That's not a success. It just did more or less what it was supposed to. But the reality is, when the goal was to bring down the cost of health care, not health insurance, but health care in America, it had just the opposite effect. But the Joyanne Reeds of the world, the Stephanie Rules, the Lawrence O'Donnells, the Jen Psakis, the Rachel Maddows of the world, they would just go on that one side. And that's why civics is broken. Anyway, we're going to come back later on. We're going to be joined in a second by Scott Shepard from the Free Enterprise Project. Later on, we're going to talk about what John Kerry had to say today. I'm Andrew Langer. This is Tony Katz Today. I see what Carl's doing here. Just a just a little subtle dig at the tax folks out there who want to take the money and run. I'm Andrew Langer. I'm in for Tony Katz today on Tony Katz Today. Joining us right now, I've been wanting to talk to Scott for a bit. We didn't get a chance to meet up at CPAC, and I screwed things up last week with trying to get him on the air. But he's joining us now. His name is Scott Shepard. He's with the Free Enterprise Project, the National Center for Public Policy Research. Scott, man, what's going on with Apple? Why do we need to be concerned? What are y'all doing about it?
Well, now I hope you're sitting down for this. This is shocking information, but it turns out that Apple is a discriminatory nightmare. It discriminates on the basis of viewpoint. It discriminates on the basis of race, sex, orientation. And you may remember the 1982 Super Bowl ad when it set itself up at the beginning of personal computers as it being the antidote, the defense against Orwell's 1984. I'll tell you what, Apple has become Orwell's 1984. What they're up to is they're poor employees, right? So they swear up and down that they don't discriminate against their employees on the basis of viewpoint. But then they refuse to add protections against viewpoint discrimination to their EEO policy, even though you can't imagine the sort of things they have protections for. You can be the 17th gender, that's fine. Everything good, but no protections for viewpoint discrimination. And then they've written their policies that all of the employees have to stick to write their left-wing, woke, lunatic biases right into the policies. And if an employee violates any of those policies, then the employee is investigated. And at that moment, they're no longer allowed to speak to the press, speak to anybody about what they're being investigated about, or the grounds for it. So all of their claims that they're open and honest and anybody can come to them with complaints, that turns out to be false. And the ways they discriminate are also shot right through the company.
Sure.
So, for instance, they've got a matching program for employees for charities. You can donate to charities Apple will match. Three exclusions. One, giving to political campaigns, which isn't even charity.
Right.
Two, giving to fraternities and sororities, which, all right, buying a natty bow for kids, probably understood. But then the third one is no matching for any giving to religious or religious-affiliated institutions.
Now,
I can't imagine a clearer way of discriminating illegally and unconstitutionally against religious employees than that.
Well, I think that's true, and I'm sure that they would tie other things up in there as well. They would find some way to not give to, oh, I don't know, the National Center for Public Policy Research, which is a 501c3 organization.
They have a way for that, too. Let me tell you that system.
Yeah.
They take shareholders' assets, including our shareholders, our shareholder money, to fund the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, what the Southern Poverty Law Center does is take completely acceptable majority opinions against, to say, letting boys into and ruin girls' sports and label that hate. And then in Apple's policies are that employees can never participate in hate. So if the employees agree the girls should have their own sports, now they've committed hate and they can get fired for it.
Oh, it is crazy. So what are you guys doing at the Free Enterprise Project? In fact, tell us about the Free Enterprise Project, what you guys are up to and how you push back against this stuff.
Yeah. So we are shareholder activists. We own enough of each of these companies that we can put in shareholder proposals, and we can do the same thing from the center right that the left has been doing for 40 years, which is essentially nag and push and threaten these companies. The other side is threatening them to take explicitly left-wing policies. We don't want them to take explicitly right-wing policies. We just want to get all of these companies back to neutral, back to staying the heck out of social and political fights and doing their jobs, which is, by the way, what they're legally required to. It's
sure.
Their fiduciary duty. But as you can tell, starting from Disney, Apple, all the way down, they've completely ignored the law.
You know, let me ask you this, because it's now getting more complicated. Is all of the work that the SEC is doing, the Securities and Exchange Commission doing, in implementing these concepts of DEI and ESG, is this to get around the kind of shareholder activism that you guys are doing at the Free Enterprise Project? Right. If they make it part of their fiduciary duty, you guys can't hold them accountable anymore, can you?
Well, I mean, they've been motivated to help the left-wing agitators all through Gensler's regime, and they continue to do that while discriminating against us. We have a suit against the SEC because they've got this process where companies can ask them to review shareholder proposals to see if they should be allowed on the ballot. And in that review process, just as one for instance, if the left puts in a shareholder proposal seeking to push the company toward monitoring legal gun purchases by customers, cutting off credit to the gun industry, yep, or social credit scores about guns, then those get through. The SEC won't stop them. When we try to get these companies to obey the law and not discriminate, those are omitted by the SEC. So it's intensely big biased and violates the law, what the SEC is doing.
It really is crazy and insidious. So, I mean, is it today that the SEC's rules on climate disclosure are going into effect, or is that in the next week? I mean, how does that all play into this? How is this going to change how we view this fiduciary responsibility that these companies have?
Well, they went into effect yesterday. Lawsuits have already been filed. The good states are already going after this, and some brave energy companies. We're confident that they'll be struck down, because what it is, what Gensler's SEC is now claiming, is that companies have to reveal, at the cost of billions of dollars of compliance cost, every bit of carbon that they exude or anybody else exudes, including getting into. So if you have a farmer in your supply chain, you have to go harass him to figure out how much carbon his cows are emitting. Right. Just insanity. Sure. All in the purpose of decarbonizing according to political schedules, which we don't have the technology for. It's not scalable. It's not possible. It's not reliable. So it would leave us normal people in the dark, in the cold, whereas the people who are putting this together, Gary Gensler and his team and John Kerry and the heads of BlackRock and these other clowns that belong to the World Economic Forum, they can leave their mansion in their limo to go to the private jet to go to the World Economic Forum in the middle of the winter at the top of the Alps to make us cut our carbon footprints further and further.
It is really, I mean, that's what we've always said about these rules. The left pushes for them, especially the elites, because they don't have to live with them, do they, Scott?
That's exactly right. None of this is for them. They want to be a world class of self-appointed nobility, and they want us to be the peasants.
It really is rules for thee and not for me. Scott Shepard, how do folks find out more about the good work you guys are doing at the Free Enterprise Project?
We're at nationalcenter.org, freeenterpriseproject.org, and for the upcoming shareholder season, we have a new proxy navigator app to help you vote your proxy shares in accord with your beliefs, and that's available at the regular app stores.
I appreciate that. Take care. That's Scott Shepard, the Free Enterprise Project, National Center for Public Policy Research, www.ncppr.org. Take care, my friend. That was Scott Shepard. Listen, because that dovetails nicely into this. As we're talking about these issues of carbon footprints, I want you to hear what John Kerry had to say yesterday. He's been the climate change czar. He's stepping out. Let's play cut number one.
Russia has the ability to be able to make enormous changes if it really wanted to. I mean, if Russia has the ability to wage a war illegally and invade another country, they ought to be able to find the effort to be responsible in the climate issue. Unfortunately, because of the actions that Russia took in an unprovoked, illegal war against another nation, we have not been engaged in discussions with Russia, sadly. I say sadly because it's a loss for the world not to be able to have Russia acting constructively on this issue. But we need every country, including Russia. Russia is one of the largest emitters in the world. If Russia wanted to show good faith, they could go out and announce what their reductions are going to be and make a greater effort to reduce emissions now. And maybe that would open up the door for people to feel better about what Russia is choosing to do at this point in time.
I mean, that is just insane. Oh, if Russia announced they were going to cut emissions, people would feel better about their invasion of Ukraine. That's what the elites think. That's the way the progressives think. When we come back, we got Robert Bork Jr. joining us. I'm Andrew Langer, in for Tony Katz. This is Tony Katz Today. Everybody, we're going to continue this discussion of how the apparatchiki in the bureaucracy are working to implement this progressive, some might even say Marxist, agenda at the highest levels of our government, drilling into our everyday lives. We just talked to Scott Shepard from the Free Enterprise Project. Now we're talking with Bob Bork. Robert Bork Jr. is president of the Antitrust Education Project and heads up the Bork Group, the eldest son of the late Judge Robert H. Bork. You all might remember that gentleman's name, that scholar's name. But let's talk about this, Bob. I appreciate you coming on. The Federal Trade Commission. Now, actually, Bob, let me pull it back a little bit. I've spent a lot of time in the last week that I've been filling in for Tony talking about what I call the whole of government approach to regulation. That is, the Biden administration has an ideological goal, and they use multiple agencies to go after it. And one of the best examples of this is the expansive role of the FTC in implementing this agenda. I was at a meeting of folks who deal with tech policy. They're used to dealing with the FCC. Few of them had ever dealt with the FTC before. They're weighing in on things. Talk about Lina Khan and Lina Khan's tenure as chairwoman of the Federal Trade Commission.
Sure. Well, Lina Khan was nominated by,
No worries, we can hear you fine.
Okay, for some reason it was beeping in my ear. I apologize. Anyway, Lina Khan was nominated by Joe Biden at the beginning of his term 3 years ago and was confirmed to be a commissioner, not the chair. When she got confirmed, with the help of some Republicans who thought that she would be beaten up on big tech companies, and they thought that was a good idea. As soon as she was sworn in, Joe Biden made her the chair, and it's been downhill ever since.
Sure.
Lina Khan is an ideologue. She's 34 years old, or was at the time, I guess she was confirmed, and she has been on a mission to get big tech companies, particularly Amazon, for a long time. And so she started bringing cases, many of which she's lost because she brings cases that don't comport with the law that, frankly, is the outgrowth of my father's work in antitrust back in the 60s and 70s. It was published in 1978 in a book called The Antitrust Paradox. And then the Supreme Court adopted his thinking in a case called Ryder v. Sonatone. Anyway, 45 years later, these folks think it's time to blow up a system that has worked so well for 45 years. Because they don't like big. Big is bad. Monopolies are bad, even if they're not monopolies. They're bad. Anything
sure.
Big is bad. So this is what. So she's this whole government approach that you talk about is what the Biden administration has put in place across the executive branch, and you know, with people like Lina Khan leading it from the independent,
so-called independent agency. Yeah,
The FTC and Jonathan Cantor, the Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division at the DOJ. Anyway, so they're losing cases right and left. The courts are kicking them to the curb. You know, they're not willing to endorse this charade. But you know, they've won a couple here and there, and
right.
they've got their sights now on basically remaking the U.S. economy,
right?
In a Marxist, as a Marxist
paradise.
Project.
Yeah.
Yeah, this paradise.
Is,
there you go. That's the word I was looking for.
This is what we're talking about, right? It's this incremental approach. They stake out a position. They let you know where they're going. They say, okay, we'll move it. Even if we move it down the field, right? If it takes us a couple of different games, we move the ball down the field by inches or maybe a couple of yards at a time. Eventually, we'll get a touchdown. That's our goal is to go down that road.
They would love to win, but they don't mind losing. In a piece I wrote in The Hill, that came out last Sunday, a couple days ago, I noted that an investigation done by the House Judiciary Committee pulled up a bunch of, did a bunch of interviews with staff at the FTC,
sure,
staff, and, oh, and got a bunch of emails from FTC employees, basically saying, I don't know what she's trying to do.
You know something?
She doesn't. Yeah?
Hold on for a second. I had a conversation with one of those FTC staffers. I was at a thing, and an FTC, someone who I know who comes very much from the progressive side of things, pulled me aside and said, you know, I don't know what she's doing here. Sorry, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what she said. You know, it's apparent to the staff that she doesn't share the staff's goal of completing quality work. And this is what the report said, and winning cases. Because the chair wants to force Congress to enact legislative change instead of winning cases in litigation.
You know,
that's what they think is going on over there, and it's insane.
You know, Bob, it's interesting because, by the way, we're talking with Bob Bork. He is the president of the Antitrust Education Project. It reminds me of something. As you said, she was 34 when she got nominated, which means that let's assume that she went to college right out of law school, graduated college 22, graduated law school at 25, meaning that she was practicing law for just about 9 years, which at any major law firm would have meant that she had just possibly made junior partnership if she got in on her first try.
I don't think she's ever practiced law at a law firm.
Here's my point, though. My point is that you know, you're just really understanding the way the world works, you know, within your first decade of getting out of law school. You come out of law school with sort of one, you know, you're filled with all the ideological nonsense of your law professors. Then you get out into the real world and you start to understand the way the world works. To become the head of the Federal Trade Commission at age 34 is just insane, is my point. You don't know you're going to lead with that ideological arm. That's what they want. That's my point.
It doesn't matter what you don't know. It's what you believe.
Yes. Yes. Facts don't matter. We just got through talking about this. Let me ask you this before I let you go, because I've had this conversation with our colleague Jessica Malugin over at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Sure.
About the issues of the FTC and administrative courts. I haven't talked about any of that this week. Talk about how the deck is stacked against anybody who wants to challenge the FTC decision making internally.
Well, you touched on the fact that in many cases, the FTC acts as judge, jury, and executioner because
wow.
You know, they bring a case. It's tried before an administrative law judge at the FTC who works for the FTC. If the administrative law judge rules in your favor, the commission can overrule it.
Yeah.
Or if you lose to the administrative law judge, then you have to appeal to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. You know, this can go on for a long time. I'll tell you one thing, though. This is going to last much longer than her term. Her term is 7 years, and there are going to be cases that she started, like with Amazon and others, that are going to be going on for a decade, because that's how long some antitrust cases take. And ultimately, they'll go to the Supreme Court. And frankly, I have great hope that the Supreme Court will continue to uphold the precedents it's been setting since the last 45 years in antitrust in support of the consumer welfare standard, which puts the consumer first, and will throw a lot of this garbage out. But,
Bob,
you know,
it's
expensive.
We got to leave it there. I do a longer form interview podcast called The Lunch Hour for the Federal Newswire in D.C. I got to get you on there because you and I think it's been a long time talking about these things. I got to spend some time talking with you about your being the managing editor of Regulation Magazine, one of my favorites. Anyway, Bob Bork, how do folks find out about the good work you guys are doing at the Antitrust Education Project?
Well, we named our website antitrusteducationproject.org. Saves time.
Simple and straightforward.
On Twitter or X or whatever it is, at AntitrustEDU.
At AntitrustEDU, I'm going to go follow them right now. Bob, thank you so very much for joining us today.
It's so much fun talking to you. Thanks very much.
Take care. That was Robert Bork, Jr., the president of the Antitrust Education Project. I love things that are named very simply and straightforward. I like that. My one of my favorite monuments in Washington, D.C. is the aptly named House Where Lincoln Died. What does it commemorate? Well, it's the house where Lincoln died. It is what it is. So the Antitrust Education Project, go and check it out. I'm Andrew Langer. This is Tony Katz Today. One of the best songs ever. I know, getting towards the tail end of my tenure here for Tony while he's been away. This song holds special significance for a lot of reasons. This is Everyday People, of course, by Sly and the Family Stone. And it's one that my daughter used to love me to sing to her. You know, we was talking to Natasha Owens early on in the show, if you missed it, the first hour, singer. I talk about how much I love music and love singing. That's one I used to sing to my daughter all the time when she was a baby, my younger daughter. And that was one that she loved. Loved to have me just play it. You know, that's all good. So that, you know, different strokes for different folks. My own beliefs are in this song. Anyway, it's all good. So I want to go here. So as we've been talking about, the State of the Union is tonight, and how much I envy whoever's going to be on the air for Tony tomorrow to be able to talk about this State of the Union, to break down the nonsense that's in there, the many, many lies that are going to be told. I don't even know how you do a show. I mean, I do know, because I've done these before, but, you know, there's so much in these States of the Union. You know, it's just going to be, and then of course you've got both of the reactions that are going to have happen afterwards. I'm going to have to watch the Tucker Carlson response. Apparently Donald Trump's going to be live streaming during it, to do his commentary. I miss those days. I loved it when Dennis Miller would do a Mystery Science Theater 3000 kind of live review as to what was happening in the State of the Union. Anyway, one of the questions that's come up is whether or not the president is going to utter the name Lakin Riley, the nursing student in Georgia that was brutally murdered by an illegal immigrant. Lots of questions being asked of the White House as to whether or not that name is going to be out there. Getting ahead of this narrative as well is Mike Johnson, Speaker Michael Johnson, who has offered up a Lakin Riley Act. Let's play cut number 17 there.
Republicans are pushing the Lakin Riley Act. You want to get this through quickly. Why is this so important to you?
Well, it's so important because we got to ensure that this can't happen again. Republicans will not stand for the release of dangerous criminals into our communities, and that's exactly what the Biden administration has done. Lakin is just one of the tragic examples of innocent American citizens who have lost their lives, been brutally and violently attacked by illegal criminals who are roaming our streets because they've allowed them in. So the Lakin Riley Act, what it will do is ensure that ICE has to arrest and detain criminals who are aliens in the country, and that we'll deport them back to where they came from. And we're also going to allow the states to sue the federal government for its refusal to enforce federal law. We're doing everything we can as House Republicans and Republicans in Congress to enforce upholding the rule of law and sanity, frankly, about this policy. We have got to secure that border, and the president has the authority right now to do it, John, and he won't. And we're going to be highlighting that here all day tomorrow during the State of the Union and all those festivities.
Here's the thing, you know, and you know that the left's reaction to all of this is, I didn't pull the clip from the other night about the fact that they're so focused on this because they are black and brown people, which is, you know, again, it all always is distilled down into race. Donald Trump, he because he can't run against X, Y, and Z, he's demonizing the folks at the border. You know, here's the thing that I come back to. These could be legitimate aliens. They could be extraterrestrials. And I would be equally concerned and infuriated at what's going on here. Right? If these were legitimate extraterrestrials that were coming into the United States, killing people on the roads with drunk driving, assaulting people, brutally murdering people, we would be doing something to make sure that there are no more extraterrestrials coming into America. You know, we would probably wind up, what was that movie, District 9? You know, we'd have them all down in South Africa on the outskirts of Pretoria, whatever it was, Johannesburg. That's what we would wind up doing. But because the left has so thoroughly flummoxed this system for a variety of different goals, this is where we are now. I want to shift gears for a second. So this is important, the Laken Riley Act. And obviously we also know that they want to make sure that this is yet another opportunity to for the Democrats to show where they stand on all of this. Do they stand with the American people and making sure that America is kept safe? Or do they stand with the people who are you know, coming into our border, demanding goods and services from our government and from the taxpayers, and who are harming the American citizens? You know, make them go on the record again. Keep doing it. Meanwhile, while all of this is going on, this is fascinating to me. Chuck Schumer, senator from New York, Democratic Senate leader, was all over the George Santos story. We've got a new superseding indictment of Senator Robert Menendez from New Jersey. And yet Chuck Schumer refuses to say whether or not Menendez should resign. Let's play cut number two.
Senator Menendez is facing another round of indictments. Is it time for him to resign? And if it's not time yet, what will it take?
Look, the bottom line, as I've said, the Senate has certain standards that we must live up to. I am very disappointed that Senator Menendez has not lived up to those standards.
Let me just begin. Why are you okay with him serving in your caucus, sitting on committees, attending classified briefings when he's been charged with bribery, conspiracy, obstruction of justice?
As I've said, Senate has standards. We should all be living up to those standards. I'm deeply disappointed that Senator Menendez has not.
All right, you can end it there. I mean, it's like Santos, you know, he had to go. He had to go. The Republicans made sure he was gone. Schumer was all over that, talking about that, holding Republicans accountable, you know. But Menendez, no. No, we're not going to take any votes. We're not going to expel him. You know, he should go. He should resign. I'm disappointed he won't resign. But we're not gonna take that extra step here. We're not gonna actually do anything about it. That's funny because I'm about to go away with family over the weekend, and I got asked a question a couple of years ago about gun control in the House. This is after one of the shootings, and was asked whether or not I thought that the Republicans would pass any meaningful gun control legislation, and I didn't want to get into it and why this was all stupid with this family member. So I said, no, probably not. And this person then said, well, why do you think that? I said, well, tradition mostly, making a joke about it. I mean, you have to make some jokes about these things. Otherwise, you're just going to cry. Listen, we got more to talk about in terms of the State of the Union. Going to be joined in the next hour by Matt Welch. Going to be talking with Devin Westhill about litigation in the Supreme Court. Oh, and Cringe Jean-Pierre's got a really weird laugh. I've got to spend some time talking about that. I am Andrew Langer, in for Tony Katz today. This is, of course, Tony Katz Today.